My name is Lauren Elkin, and my book is called Scaffolding.
Lauren Elkin's novel, Scaffolding, follows two couples who live in the same apartment in Paris, but decades apart. The novel explores love, desire, and fidelity, and the couples share similar experiences at times, particularly when it comes to their professions as psychoanalysts and their involvement in the feminist movement. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Lauren Elkin. So could you set up the novel for us? Tell us briefly about Scaffolding.
So Scaffolding is a book about love and desire and the different shapes that we try to make for our lives so that they can contain as much of those things as possible, sometimes to the detriment of the relationships that already exist. But it's a book about hauntings and the ways in which the places we live are saturated with the people and the events that have lived there and taken place there. And it's, you know, it's basically just about trying to make your way in a world that, you know, you didn't create and you didn't have a choice in, and negotiating the kinds of limitations that you butt up against as you journey through.
I have a question about the hauntings later, but
yeah,
let's talk about structure for a moment. The first and third parts of this book, the story is in first person from Anna's perspective, but we don't learn her name until page like 78. Are these journal entries?
Oh, really?
Unless I just
That's
missed
so funny.
It.
Yeah, no, it's possible that we don't. Yeah, there's this kind of trend nowadays, right, for nameless narrators. But yeah, her name, I wasn't trying to cover it up, but yeah, I guess it's not like at the forefront of my mind in terms of what's important. But yeah, there are some journal entries. I mean, there's a moment where she goes back to her journals that she's been keeping for a long time at the prompting of her therapist to try to help her get through this moment of just complete grief and blockage that she's experiencing as a result of having lost a pregnancy in the middle of her second trimester. The question of who a novel is addressed to is one that is always interesting for me. And in fiction that I've written in the past, I've always made it really clear, like, if it's in the first person, why, who are they talking to? It eventually becomes clear at a certain moment. And then for this book, I decided to stop worrying about that and just kind of let us be in this ambiguous first person perspective. There are scenes where she's talking to her therapist, and obviously many other scenes with the other characters. But those moments that you're talking about that feel kind of journal-like, as in keeping a diary, I like to think of them as her kind of just musing. You know, she's stuck in her apartment by herself. She can't bring herself to leave. Her husband has gone to London. She's lost this pregnancy. She can't go to work. She's stopped seeing patients because she's a psychotherapist. And she's just kind of like sorting through her life, I guess, in real time.
So let's talk about part two, because we're receiving a story through like a similar perspective, but this time it's I guess it would be Henri in Florence. Mm-hmm. And we alternate perspectives. One time we're like in Henri's head, one time we're in Florence's head. And they are in the exact same apartment where Anna currently lives. Talk to me about writing from a place that was the same but was completely different.
Oh, it was so much fun. I mean, like, who doesn't love imagining all of the different lives and, you know, people who've passed through? Well, maybe there are some people who don't like that. But, you know, I'm very imaginatively inspired by the idea that the places that I inhabit have had all of these different lives and different histories. So, yeah, setting myself this kind of constraint was actually incredibly freeing because, you know, what if they were going through the exact same thing? What if, you know, the couple in the present day and the couple in 1972 coincide, not just spatially, although, you know, not temporally, but coincide in terms of the issues that they're having around marriage and parenthood and fidelity and love and desire and psychoanalysis. And it was also a good chance to just think about how far we've come, how much things have changed since 1972. It's a kind of like chance for me to just nerd out and like immerse myself in the early 70s in Paris and to think about like the heady intellectual climate, you know, with people like Jacques Lacan and Roland Barthes and Derrida all lecturing at the same time. So I thought, you know, let Florence be going to Lacan's seminars, attending those seminars to be able to grapple with those ideas herself. So yeah, it was just a moment to sort of let my imagination run riot, born of something that I myself have experienced in my life in these cities.
Before I ask about psychoanalysis, let's talk about what's going on in this apartment, because there were a couple of moments in the book when Anna felt like she could see past lives of her apartment. And this is a quote, but there's something else too, some presence, maybe hers. She's a kindly spirit, I think, but she has to go. There are too many people living in our apartment. And also, this is another quote, for a minute, I have the strangest feeling like I can see through the wall to the living room where a man sits reading. And then there's a moment in part two, though, from Florence's perspective. Working in the kitchen this evening, I have the strangest feeling like I can see what Henri is doing on the other side of the wall, as if there is no wall. So what is going on here?
Oh, just fun. Good times. there's an element of surrealism in the book. I wanted there to be these kind of moments of undecidability and ambiguity where you're like, how does that work? Why is she seeing a man in her living room? And then in part two, we find out, you know, there was a man sitting there exactly where she's.
And the wall is removed.
Yeah, exactly. And then she does go on to knock down that wall. So, it, you know, like there's at one point, there's a grapefruit that just appears out of nowhere. There's a lot of engagement with surrealist artists and poets. You know, Paris is the city where they invented surrealism. I think that there's something really kind of magical and just densely imaginative. And I don't know, it's a city rich with possibilities for thinking about lives and past lives and people's lives. I myself have, you know, sometimes walking around Paris, I feel like if I just kind of squint, I can see people like in old fashioned outfits, you know, just walking down the street in front of me. And I can't, obviously, but I feel like it's not just like interesting to me as a novelist, but I think it's sort of important to have a sense of ourselves as existing in history and not just, you know, oh, we're so new and modern and we're life is just the most modern that it's ever been. But to think that people have always thought of themselves as extremely modern, you know, with regard to the past, and that things now are just as advanced as they've ever been. But then to see, you know, okay, if people have always thought that, and it obviously hasn't been true because now we're more advanced than they were, you know, what does that mean about how we think about our own present moment and all the things that we have yet to work out and all the ways that we can, you know, think about making the world a better place, so to speak. I was not up watching the debate last night, but I was up early this morning checking the news. So this is a moment of great, like, political possibility. What kind of world do we want to make? And I think that's kind of underscored by the presence of the couleurs in the novel, these kind of feminist activists who are pasting up slogans on the walls of Paris about femicide and violence against women. And there's this real sense that women can take back the city and take back the narrative and take back their lives, that we can speak truth to power and reclaim some measure of power over our own bodies.
So there were some parallels between the two time periods. And like you just touched on, both these characters were involved in the feminist movement. You talked about the signs going up and you included the signs in your book. And in the author's note in the back, you explained that these are real. And you also gave the English translations. So talk to me about these signs that have gone up in Paris.
Yeah, I first started noticing them in 2019, which is when they first started going up. And they're so visually arresting, you know, they're just plain capital letters on A4 paper, sentences on the wall of the city. And they include like the names of women who've been killed by their domestic partners and the date of their death and the way that they were killed. But they also include slogans about, you know, feminism and women's rights over their body and, you know, who gets to be a woman and all kinds of sort of important political notions around gender and freedom and even, you know, colonialism and war. And, you know, it really, it's not limited to just women's studies stuff. And I think I don't know. I didn't intend to include them in the book, but one day I was working on one of the late scenes where Anna's just walking through the city for, you know, pages and pages and pages. And I was trying to summon up Paris and to see what she would see. And I just saw one of the collages and I included that without even thinking about it. And then as I was going back and looking over the section that I'd written, I thought, oh, that's interesting that I just include, like, what does that mean that that's there? And then that opened up a whole, you know, like layer of possibility for those collages to be throughout the book. And then I was like, well, of course, Clémentine, this young like feminist activist, she's going to be out there pasting them up. So then it became part of Clémentine's character. And then it became a kind of, well, then if Clémentine is going out and posting these up, maybe she's inviting Anna to go with her. So it was really just born of like that kind of automatic suggestion that of course that would be within Anna's frame of reference in the city. And then it became just a major theme in the book.
There were so many parallels between the two storylines. You know, like you just mentioned, both Anna and Florence they're active in the feminist movement, but they also are both psychoanalysts. And I know nothing about psychoanalysis, but I found the deep thinking throughout just absolutely fascinating. Talk to me about your interest in psychoanalysis.
I'm so glad you enjoyed that part of the novel. I really did write it for a reader who knew nothing about it. I didn't want this to read like, you know, you have to have Lacan 101 before you can get to scaffolding. But I first studied Lacan when I was in grad school doing a PhD in English. And in my day, anyway, you read a lot of French theory as part of your training. And so we read Lacan's essay on the mirror stage, where he argues that we come into being as individuals through that moment where we look in the mirror and we realize that we are separate from our mothers. And he argues that like that kind of individuality and subjectivity is predicated on a moment of loss and lack, and that we spend the rest of our lives trying to get back that feeling of wholeness that we had with our mother. And that basically explains, you know, desire in a nutshell, like why I need a new sweater or why I want, you know, a new couch or why I want to have sex with someone who's not my partner, you know, that kind of like unfulfillable, unquenchable need for something that you don't have. It's impossible to make it go away because it's part of who we are as people. So that in a nutshell is what really drew me to psychoanalysis and to Lacan, this idea that we can tell ourselves stories about what we're feeling and what we're going through, but it's so tied to something that's within us that, you know, it can be a very powerful tool to reckon with and to come to terms with.
You know, there was a paragraph near the end of the novel where the narrator, Anna, who sees patients, I mean, she is a psychoanalyst, but she also goes to her own therapist, Esther, and she's reflecting on the fact that she, quote, you know, feels gratitude that she makes the time to do it. Even if I'm paying her, even if it's her job, it doesn't diminish the fact that she's invested. This really captured my attention. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that therapists are amazing people, like that they spend their days just listening to other people's problems and really thinking deeply about them. Like, you know, I see a therapist, my therapist goes away and like thinks about my problems and then comes back to me. And she's like, this is what I was thinking about is going on with you. And it's so funny. I mean, if just in the past few years, we've seen the success of shows like In Treatment and Couples Therapy, which I love. Like the woman in Couples Therapy, like she's just the most compelling figure. And she also goes, and there's all kinds of scenes with her own therapist where she's talking about how she's feeling while she's talking to these people and how she either really wants them to break up or she's really rooting for them or they bring up all this stuff in her own life. I love that that show makes room for her to be a person. So yeah, I thought it was a great joke that my therapist kind of like loses her mind a little bit and then needs a therapist. So that was sort of the reason for that.
Talk to me about the title. I mean, I'm curious about all of the scaffolding that was all over Paris, but I'm also curious about, you know, the layered meaning.
Yeah, so there was actually scaffolding in my life. Like that was what prompted me to write a book about a woman living in a house, a building that's being refaced in Paris. And just that kind of like existential experience or crisis of being in a place that's, it feels like it's under attack all day long. You know, it's just always being hammered at and chiseled at and, you know, just there's scraping and grinding and there's no escape from it. And it goes on for months. And I worked at home at the time and had a dog who would like bark his head off at the workers that you would see. So, you know, as a novelist, you're looking for like really rich moments that you can sort of import into your book. And I was like, well, this has got to be this novel that I'm writing about love and desire. Like, she has to be living in this place where she feels so just stuck and frustrated. And, you know, the light goes away. She can't even look out the window anymore. Everything's dark and noisy all the time. But an interesting moment for me thinking about that came when I realized that the scaffolding was actually connected to the building in a way, that it wasn't just this freestanding structure that was next to it, but actually there's like a point of damage beyond the sort of experience of restoration that's happening. It's also, there's something like hurting the building as well. So that was my way in. I was like, I need to think about this idea of renovation. I mean, she's redoing her kitchen at the same time. This idea of like needing to reface our lives, ourselves, to go through something and come out the other end changed. But the metaphor for scaffolding that's great in the French sense is that every 20 years this happens. So you might like reface your building, but then it's not like done. It's not like better. It's going to get dirty again. Other stuff's going to happen to it. And then it's going to need another refacing. So I was kind of playing with the kind of novelistic convention that a character begins in one place, goes through an experience that transforms them, and then ends somewhere else. I wanted to be like, that's not what life is like. Like, you don't just change and then that's it. It's just that the frame of a novel or a play or a film gives us a slice of that person's life in which they go through something. But I wanted to kind of gesture beyond the frame of this novel and suggest like, she might have gone through this, but that doesn't mean it's all sewn up and she's better now.
My French is bad. And I found myself grateful that I was reading a preview copy on my iPad, because when I came upon a French phrase I didn't understand, I could highlight it and have the iPad just translate it for me immediately.
Oh, amazing.
And so it's interesting that you are a translator. Mm-hmm. You chose to leave some passages untranslated.
Yeah, because I wasn't a translator when I was writing the book. I wanted to, you know, convey this like world of Frenchness. I wanted it to feel like you had just kind of stumbled into a French cafe and were like overhearing someone talking about their life. And so a lot of the French is kind of ambiance, and some of it, and this is, you know, a factor of being like a Franco-American person, that, you know, like Anna, whose father is American and her mother is French, she just thinks in two languages and her world exists in two languages. And so I thought it would be truer to the spirit of Anna for there to be just this kind of mix. And I wrote the book in French at the same time. So there's a French manuscript. And a lot of the moments that in this version are in French, in the French version are in English. So there's a kind of like, I need to amuse myself somehow. So that's how I do it.
That's interesting. Do you have a hope for this book? What do you want readers to take away from it?
That is such a good question. It's really hard to prescribe anything for, you know, like a particular takeaway. It doesn't have a particular argument per se, but I was hoping to suggest other ways for thinking about love and fidelity other than the stories that we've inherited. I was very eager, or careful, I guess I should say, not to make it about what happens. Like, does Anna stay with her husband? Does she leave her husband? Do she and the guy get together? Do they not get together? Like, it wasn't about that. I wanted to shift the conversation about adultery away from the actual act and the outcome and more onto the process of desiring and needing. And I wanted to think kind of critically and imaginatively about other ways of thinking about that desire that aren't within a realm of like morality or punishment, but more just like, what do we desire and why do we want it and why do we think that we should have it? So yeah, I think that it's more, I would like people to ask questions and think about their desires rather than giving them a specific sort of, this is what you should do.
Well, the book is Scaffolding. Lauren Elkin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Elkin, author of the book Scaffolding, which was published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Books and Whatnot is a podcast for readers, where we talk about the titles we've read lately and those bookish little discoveries along the way.
You know what, Beth? I have just realized what my favorite new genre is. And my favorite new genre is WTF.
It is.
Listen to Books and Whatnot every month from KMUW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.